Well, our government has been telling refugees it's safe to go back to Afghanistan. But coming up, a story about the frightening conditions Afghans are really facing in their homeland, and that's even before last week's earthquake. We recorded this story about a week ago before the earthquake with Ahmed Shujar in Kabul, someone who works with Human Rights Watch, and he has been through the earthquake in the last few days, and we know that because he's okay, because he's been on Facebook with Noel Debien since the quake. And Ahmed says the worst of the death and destruction occurred further north than Kabul.
Ahmed Shujar from Human Rights Watch. Ahmed Shujar, it's great to have you on the program. I know that you've been talking to people in Australia about Afghanistan, where you come from. Who have you been talking to? Give us a sense of where you've been.
I've spoken to community organizations. I've spoken to at least one body in the government. I've spoken to the Australian Institute of International Affairs and at a couple of universities. Basically, my job has been to update everybody here about the situation of human rights in Afghanistan and what it means for Australia as they're reviewing the cases of about 8,000 to 10,000 Afghan refugees, boat arrivals, so to speak, who are still being processed.
In which case, we really do need to speak to you because, of course, in this country at the moment, we're being effectively told that it's safe to send people back to Afghanistan. It's all fine. Now, you live there, and I need to, and I'm really interested to know, and I know the listener's really interested to know, we sort of want to go, what's it like, but where do you start? So let's start with Kabul, where you live. When you walk down the street, when you do your daily business, do you feel safe? Is Kabul an easy place to be? Tell us about it.
I don't try to walk down the street in Kabul very much,
really?
To be honest with you. A year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, everybody thought if you avoided the roads during rush hour in the morning and the evening, you'd be safe because rush hour is when a lot of the diplomats, the government officials who are really targets of the insurgency go home and come back from work. And then everybody thought, well, if you avoided foreign embassies and if you avoided government offices, you'd be fine because those are targets as well. What's happened over the last year and a half is that this sort of these pockets of time and bubbles of space where you felt safe in Kabul city have sort of eroded because of the emergence of this phenomenon called the sticky bomb, which is really, you know, magnetic bomb stuck to police patrol vehicles, to government vehicles.
What, they just pop it on the car?
Pop it on the car, and the police vehicle might be in front of a kindergarten or a high school, and it might go off. And so the randomness of the acts of violence that transcend a safe space and a safe time have really made it difficult for people in Kabul. You know, and then they thought if you stayed away from the streets, you'd be safe. But then this August, there was a huge truck bomb in a residential area at 1 a.m. at night, which killed and injured about 400 people in their sleep at their homes. And so the sense that you're going to be safe if you stayed home at night, even that sort of sense of safety was shattered this August.
Yeah, this is the capital city.
And this is the capital city.
Well, I was going to then ask you some pretty practical questions like, well, how does the police force work? How effective is it? It sounds like it doesn't work very effectively already before I even ask the question.
Well, the police force is tasked with law enforcement, but it's also tasked with counterinsurgency. So they're the front lines of the fight against the Taliban, the fight against now what this group calling themselves ISIS or Daesh in Afghanistan. Mm. They are poorly trained, relatively badly equipped, and so they have a lot of challenges on their hands, and sometimes many things do fall through their cracks. And so even though they have a lot of challenges, I think every day they wake up, they try to do their best, but I think their best is usually not enough because the overwhelming odds of what they're facing is it's quite obvious that it's just too much for them.
When you say you wouldn't walk down the street all that much because it doesn't feel safe, you're currently dressed pretty much as any Western educated businessman would be. Is that what you would wear on the street? Would you be that identifiable?
I wouldn't wear the suit every day in Kabul, although I do wear the suit in Kabul for meetings and when I go to events like that. There is a large number of people who do wear Western dress in Kabul, and that's not a big deal.
So you can do it?
Yes, you can.
When you talk about insurgency, I think it's hard for us to understand in a culture like ours where everything is stable. Like, it's just about everything is stable. How close does the insurgency feel to you, Ahmed, when you're there, when you're in your hometown?
Let me tell you a story. My little brother, who's 13, I took him out once at about 11 p.m. at this really crowded part of town that stays up very late, unlike some cities in Australia that I've been to, unfortunately, including Canberra. But I took my little brother, a 13-year-old, out to get a fresh fruit juice. We were sitting waiting for our order to arrive, and then suddenly some boom went off nearby. And I thought, oh, there's construction going on. It must be from the construction. Something fell on the roof. But Blair said, no, that doesn't really sound like construction. Turns out that this was actually a rocket that landed outside of an embassy, which was barely a kilometer away from where we were staying. And so how close is the insurgency? It is very close. It is in the street over from you. It is a lot of times when a bomb blast happens in Kabul, pretty much everybody can hear it. It's not a huge city, Kabul. And sometimes you can even hear the gunfire that follows these bomb blasts. I used to live in a place where every time there was an incident, I used to hear the U.S. Embassy's duck and cover alarm. It would say, this is not an exercise, duck and cover. And that gives this eerie sense to the entire city, and that comes to your, you know, to your bedroom in the morning. It comes to your bedroom at night.
Well, let's go outside Kabul then. Is it better outside Kabul? Is Kabul a target? Are there places in Afghanistan where you would not be feeling this sort of, sounds like, intensity? It sounds like the Intifada in Israel. It sounds like all of the worst places I've ever heard of.
Well, look, in Kabul, people fall in love, people go to school, people get married, people do people things. But there's a sense of suspended animation in the air that anything can happen at any moment. So people live with that in their consciousness, and they carry it about in their daily lives. Outside of Kabul, a lot of rural areas, there's a lot of insecurity in rural areas also. The challenge there is not magnetic bombs as much as it is IEDs, which are these improvised explosive devices planted on the roads, hoping, the insurgents hope, that they would sort of catch a police vehicle or some other security vehicle, but usually it catches civilian vehicles, people going to wedding ceremonies or coming back from wedding ceremonies, people going to the doctor or coming back. And there's the added threat of militias. These are armed men who are either pro-government or fighting on behalf of the government, but still prey on the people. They sort of extort money from the people, and they sort of take out their sort of decades-long grudges against the local people. There's a lot of ethnic tension that emanates from that. Certain parts of Afghanistan are relatively safer than others, but I think the security has so palpably deteriorated over the last year that it's difficult to say that someplace is safe.
Well, I did want to. It sounds like a bit of a naive question to ask, but I was going to ask, are things improving or not? It sounds like they're not improving. You've just said that. Why are things becoming more difficult, do you think? What are you observing?
Things in terms of security started going downhill, so to speak, in 2007, 2008, 2009. And that was when we had more than 100,000 U.S. and international troops, including Australian troops in Afghanistan. And that's because the Taliban were becoming more assertive. They were, honing their tactics, their insurgent tactics. And what we have now, as of December the 31st of 2014, is that 100-some-odd-thousand troops or foreign troops are gone. And so on the front lines are Afghan troops who do not have the sophisticated intelligence capabilities or the sophisticated air power to sort of, for lack of a better term, swat down Taliban congregations. And so now the Taliban are able to sort of gather men in massive numbers, in hundreds of numbers, and maybe sometimes even in thousands, according to press reports.
Well, can I ask a question which might seem, again, naive to you, but Afghanistan has been in a difficult space for a long, long time. That makes it difficult for schools to function. It makes it difficult for everything to function. When you talk about literacy and the Afghan troops, how sophisticated a force is it? Is everybody in Afghanistan like you or not? You sound Harvard educated, to be honest.
Well, thank you. That's very flattering. I didn't go to Harvard, contrary to what I wished. I did go to a U.S. high school. I've been extremely lucky. I'm sorry, a U.S. college, not a high school. I've been extremely lucky to have had the opportunities that I have. First of all, to start learning this language from a very early age.
Oh, you speak it like a native, obviously. It's not your first language, though, I presume.
No, it isn't. I started learning it when I was 9, maybe 10.
Wow.
So I've been with the language for a while.
I'm an ex-English teacher and you're accentless. That's amazing.
I'm an accent.
Well, you are accented, but it's American, to put it that way.
I'm an ex-English teacher too. And so here in Australia, I've actually met some of my former students who are doing really well now.
And who also have an American accent, I'll bet.
Who have actually adopted an Australian accent for the most part.
Good on them. Well, my question, though, is about troops, though, because as Americans have tried to withdraw, or Australians have tried to withdraw, the idea is to say, well, now Afghanistan Pakistan, you can run yourself, is the conceit we have in our minds that, you know, we sort it out and move out, is the most naive way I can put it. How sophisticated are those Afghan forces tactically? Are they educated men and women? Are they coping?
I think the forces, by all accounts, are actually struggling to cope. A lot of it is because in a country where the skills for anything are at really short supply, the most educated men and women would rather not go into the armed forces and have to fight the Taliban. They would rather sit in an office and get you know, a better salary and do work that doesn't directly put them in danger. And so, pretty much most societies, that's probably how it functions. People with the skills do skilled jobs. And so a lot of the Afghan forces, they've had to go through literacy classes as they've been going through boot camp in the police.
Really?
They've learned to learn the English language. They've been taught how to use a computer so they can...
Is English being used widely, is it?
Because a lot of their mentors and trainers from Australia, the US, or the UK, Germany, and France, you know, they're
use English as the common language,
right? And the Border Protection Force, for example, has to read passports and letters and visa issues and all
those
things.
Right. So English is useful in that case and being used in that sense. So it sounds like our own troops. I think we brought back our interpreters, for example. I happened to, only a few months ago, speak to some of the interpreters who were brought back here. And they were brought back under a special act of parliament because they realised once our troops had withdrawn, our interpreters who'd been working with them closely, they were being picked off. Their family were being picked off by insurgents. And so a special act of parliament was made and they were brought here to Australia. So I've had the chance to speak to some of them. And they've spoken to me about... a place which, you know, a threat could be anywhere at any point. You don't know. Somebody tells somebody, oh, you get a message sent to you. I mean, they described a place which has a high level of psychological tension in it as well. Am I getting the right impression?
I think that's correct. I think that's absolutely correct. We've had cases where people have received night letters. In other cases, people have received anonymous phone calls. In other cases, people have... I mean, this is a really closely knit society. People know what other
extended
people do.
Family is something
extended
else.
Families know what you're doing, and in some cases, in some rural areas, you know, one of your cousins might actually be with the insurgency while you were working with the Australian troops, and so that level of knowledge of what my cousin does with the Australian troops is really common knowledge within the family. However, you try to hide it.
Yep. They told us that too. They tried to keep it secret. They also told us that sometimes their family had to move so that they couldn't be found because of exactly what you're explaining. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, absolutely. I mean, look, my family, I think because of the nature of my work that I do, we don't really stay in one place for years either.
That's what I was just about to ask you. What about your family? Mm-hmm. They move too. They have to move.
Yes. Part of it's because of the nature of the work that I do. But the interpreters, I think, a lot of them come from Oruzgan province. Oruzgan province, in
indeed,
terms of security,
yep.
Security is much worse than Kabul because the insurgents in those parts are able to mobilize in large numbers and challenge Afghan security forces in ground-to-ground extended firefights. The security in Oruzgan province has gotten worse. Part of it is because there has been abusive gunmen belonging to the paramilitary organization called the Afghan Local Police. Mm-hmm. There's a notorious commander in Oruzgan that we, Human Rights Watch, profiled for his abuses and everything and the impunity with which he did those abuses.
And he's still in place.
And he's still in the area.
Ahmed Shuja, direct from Afghanistan, working with Human Rights, telling us something about the situation in that country right now, and this is a first-hand account you're getting. Ahmed Shuja, can we go back to the past a bit? Because we here, I think in the minds of many of us here in Australia, we think of the Taliban because we've seen public executions, we've seen awful things, atrocities that were happening under their rule. Now, you're only a youngish man, but are you in a position to remember any of that, or were you able to steer clear of it all?
We became refugees and I grew up in Pakistan just as the Taliban were entering Kabul City. That's when they were beginning to do their first big conquest of the capital. And so I was spared a lot of that.
But
that
what year are we talking there?
This is in the 1990s, 94, 95. Mm-hmm. But obviously, you know, going out of Kabul itself is a traumatizing experience because you go through checkpoints, you go through all of these sort of unsafe areas, and and you go through a place and you're the wrong ethnicity in the wrong place. And that's quite stressful as well. A lot of people didn't make it through those badlands because of the checkpoints and the predatory practices. And so even though I was spared a lot of the violence because we left just in time, a lot of people didn't. And you experience the sort of ethnic profiling, so to speak, and the persecution that comes as a result of that profiling firsthand, and it's quite excruciating.
Well, I mean, everybody would know about Malala and the attempt on her life and that sort of triumph, I suppose. But it just reminds us that if you're a little girl and you're trying to do some good, you can get shot in the head, basically. And it sounds like that's something that people must live with.
Right, and Malala, obviously the case enough in Pakistan with the Taliban, the Pakistani Taliban, who are actually linked with the Afghan Taliban, and have, you know, broadly speaking, similar policies towards girls' education. You're absolutely right,
because there's quite a crossover. I speak to people about this between Pakistan and Afghan and Afghans and the Taliban. There seems to be ethnic bridges across there, I presume.
The Pakistani Taliban. I think they're separated in several factions, but one of the factions had pledged allegiance to Mullah Omar, the leader of the Afghan Taliban. And so even though the Pakistani Taliban focus on attacks in Pakistan, the Afghan Taliban focus on attacks in Afghanistan, they basically, at the end of the day, symbolically sort of have loyalties to the same emir or the same leader of the faithful, which is Mullah Omar. But since his death was revealed in July 2015, we just don't know yet where the Pakistani Taliban stand in that regards now.
Where does religion sit in all of this? Because this program actually is religion and ethics, and we're sort of interested in those things. And as you would know from all you read in Australia and no doubt from America too, there is a perception among some people that, you know, Islam is a violent religion. You'll hear them say that. We work hard to dispel that because we understand it's not about Islam, it's about extremism. But where does religion sit in all this in Afghanistan?
I think religion has to do or is connected in some way with some of the violence that goes on in Afghanistan.
I'm presuming you're Muslim, for example, yourself.
I was born in a Muslim family.
Right.
I was raised in a Muslim family. Religion is connected in some way with a lot of the violence, but also a lot of it's connected with, you know, the defense of the land, the defense of the honor and the chastity of our women. It's connected with a sense of national pride, a connection with the mountains and the land and the fields and the pastures that you're protecting against foreign invasion. You're protecting, or at least the justification is that you're protecting your cultural space from foreign invaders. And a lot of that is sort of couched in religious terminology and religious rhetoric. But all of this also has connections with extremist ideology that has sort of been injected into Afghanistan from, say, the madrasas where many of the Taliban studied when they were children in Pakistan. A lot of the extremist ideology came through Osama bin Laden and his Arab al-Qaeda fighters into Afghanistan. Like I said, Rumi, one of the who's mentioned in one of the
great
songs,
poets, was born in Afghanistan.
Born in Afghanistan, and he was a scholar. He too, incidentally, became sort of a refugee when the Mongols were sort of invading from Central Asia and so through Afghanistan. Mm. He was granted his father was granted political asylum by the Seljuk dynasty in Turkey. So he was an asylum seeker himself, and that's where Rumi, the scholar, became Rumi, the mystic and the Sufi. Mm. And this itinerant dervish called Shams, who rose from Tabriz in Iran, went to, you know, Aleppo, Syria, to Baghdad, and came all the way back here to Konya in Turkey. And then as soon as Shams meets, so this is an itinerant immigrant of a dervish. Mm. An immigrant meets a former asylum seeker in Turkey, and then Rumi becomes transposed, so to speak, changed into a dervish himself.
I didn't know that. Right. Poet, but not dervish. I wasn't aware of that.
And his first 40 or 30,000 verses, which has now become known as the Divan of the Shams, is really written by Rumi, in memory, in separation of his friend Shams, because Shams disappeared after a couple of years of living with Rumi in Konya, and so the streak of pluralistic, of accepting, of sort of this bandwagon of anybody can belong here, of Sufi Islam, that originated with Rumi, who's an immigrant from Afghanistan, has traditions in modern-day Afghanistan, has always had these traditions.
Well, this is my question, because most people, again, even those vaguely literate about the way Islam works, think that Sufism is really nice. You know, Sufism is good, and there are Sufi schools in Sydney, for example, and in fact, many people don't realise it's Islam, to be honest, until they get there, because they think of it so differently. And therefore, my question again is, how does religion fall in the mix? We know the extremists are there, but what do the madrasas, the schools, and other religious organisations, do they take a part in trying to stabilise the country and trying to offer a different view, is my other question.
Right, and I'll come back to that. I think that Rumi deserves more attention because a lot of the quotes translated into English on the internet of Rumi, I think are sort of devoid of the Islamic grounding and the Islamic context in which these poems are grounded in. Rumi was a scholar of Islam. He was a preacher of Islam. Yeah. He was a devout practitioner of Islam. Mm. And his poetry and his philosophy is rooted in that deep understanding, scholar's understanding of Islam. And his Rumi tradition is his books and his verses and his poems are read and practiced and understood and enjoyed all over Afghanistan.
Oh, really? Afghans know him well?
The Afghans think he's one of them.
Because he in fact was.
Yeah. There are religious education for many centuries or many, many generations in Afghanistan has really been the only form of literacy. Mm. My grandfather was literate because he learned to study the Quran. Yeah. Other people were literate because they studied the Quran, but they were never radicalized. But I think this string of this sort of streak of radicalized and sort of extremist interpretation of Islam and how that might play out into society is relatively recent in Afghanistan. It's recent as of the last couple decades, actually.
Why? Because when we looked at it, we for the outside of the Taliban looked like a Puritan movement is really what they look like to us from the outside, who want to stop all fun from happening and, in fact, will use violent means to ensure that all fun stops happening. Why did it come in? How did it come in? What was the root? Because in understanding how it came, that might be part of addressing it, in fact, I think.
So the Taliban came in the context of the civil war in Afghanistan. The civil war had been so after the Soviets left Afghanistan, that sort of the jihad against the Soviets in Afghanistan sort of lost its momentum, and now this was the time for the.
So it's that recent.
It's the 1990s.
Wow.
So then the factions that fought against the Soviets overthrew the Soviet-supported regime of Dr. Najib also. Mm. And then it was up to them to actually make a nation and build a state. And their act of state building in the 1990s faltered and failed, and it resulted in horrific, bloody conflicts. And because the state was never able to establish itself, small little commanders in the rural areas who had fought against the Soviets and had their arms and their money and their men and their structures started extorting money out of the local people. And so from the southern province of Kandahar, these religious scholars, students from Pakistani madrasas came to Afghanistan thinking that they would get rid of what they thought was extortion and buggery and all kinds of moral degeneration. And so as they came through, some people, just to get rid of the exploitative, excruciating sort of poverty and extortion they were living under, they welcomed the Taliban, who then eventually took over the whole of Afghanistan and established what you call a Puritan form of Islam, which is completely alien to Afghanistan. Afghanistan had always had a tradition of music. They've always had a tradition of dance. They've always had a tradition of poetry. And the Taliban completely outlawed that overnight. And that was a shock to the system of the entire Afghan society.
This is sort of what I'm trying to reach to, because you've chosen music number one, and I understood music to be haram, forbidden under the Taliban. In fact, it was if they heard music, they'd come after you. The religious police would come and get you. You've just spoken quite passionately, and clearly you're very interested in Rumi, and I suspect perhaps even a Sufi. You may well be, and you've spoken passionately about that. How does that sit inside Afghanistan, though? Is that a wide view, what you've just expressed there, that Rumi is us, we are Rumi, Rumi is us, and that Sufi form of Islam is widely spread, and the Taliban are sort of a weird thing?
The Taliban are indeed a weird thing. Well, obviously, there always in Afghanistan, there has been as throughout the Muslim world, there has been these sort of fundamentalist forces, people who would like to take us back to the fundamentals of what Islam was like when the Prophet was alive. Sort of this. And those forces have always been there.
The caliphate idea, of course, is effectively what it
is. Not necessarily the caliphate idea. They don't necessarily want to go back to the caliphate. They want to go back to practicing Islam the way it was done when the Taliban was there.
Also, these are Sunnis, not Shias, therefore.
And they could come from either side. Right. They could be Shias or they could be Sunnis. They could be any form of Islam. But never have they been able to assert themselves and become the political rulers of the country.
Right.
And therefore assert their ideologies in the same way. And not all of these factions that wanted to that wanted Islam to be practiced the way it was done under Prophet Muhammad talked about outlawing music. They frowned upon it, but they never really talked about a blanket ban. What the Taliban brought was a shock to the entire system of Afghan society, because we've always had singers, we've always had dancers, we've always had poets. In fact, in our little villages, you know, in the winter when the mowing was done and the wheat was taken care of and the days were short and sleepy and cold, people would gather in the village mosque and they would read poetry from Bedil and from Rumi. One literate man in the village would read it, another literate man would explain it to the rest of the village gathered in this mosque.
That means that the culture is there, the culture is alive, and it can be not only encouraged, but it's probably still dominant from what you're saying.
The culture exists everywhere, and the culture, the Taliban were able to impose their will for the 6-7 years that they were in power, but they were never able to dominate or subjugate that existing infrastructure of culture and poetry and reading. Afghanistan is a complex society. It's a highly illiterate society, but it's also a highly cultured society in the sense that it's always been given into poetry. It's always been given into the fine arts.
Mm. In your advocacy here in Australia, how much traction have you gotten getting around? You work for Human Rights Watch. Obviously, it's of great concern to you that the story of Afghanistan gets out, and we're a country which is, it seems, intent on sending people back there too when they're claiming refugee status. How much traction have you gotten so far?
So I've spoken with a lot of refugee support organizations, sort of trying to give them the first-hand information of what it feels like to be in Afghanistan, because a lot of them are sort of handling cases where people are either at sort of facing deportation or are imminently being deported. And so my job was to sort of give them ways to argue as to what that deportation would mean for that.
What it really will mean when they get off the plane.
Practically speaking, absolutely. There's been a lot of enthusiasm and thirst for understanding what it is like to live in Afghanistan even after the Australian troops have left, thinking that the conflict is over, which in fact it is not. As the Australian government seems to be arguing that it's safe for people to go back to Kabul, which we think is not. We think that there's different types of insecurity, different types of attacks and sort of targetings that are beginning to creep up. And we think that the Australian government's deportation process is not adequately considering all of those risk factors.
It's sort of an obvious question that I need to ask you. You live there. You must choose to stay there because you were once refugees yourself. You've told us through Pakistan and you grew up in America. Would you leave if you could?
I grew up in Pakistan. I just went to college in the US. I am staying in Kabul for as long as it is tenable. And I say that with the complete realization that I have the privilege that I might be able to get out in time if it comes to that, because I have this emergency escape hatch, so to speak, that I might be able to have an Australian visa or a US visa or somewhere else if it comes to that, so that I might sort of use the emergency escape exit and get out. For as long as it takes, as long as it's reasonably safe, I have a job. I do work that I find fulfilling and meaningful. I will try to stay there, and I have the support of my organization. Obviously, that means that I'm facing, on a day-to-day level, the same level of insecurity as everybody else does in Kabul, and so that's not unique.
Ahmed Shujaa, Human Rights Watch in Australia doing some advocacy and discussion for groups who are concerned about the safety of our refugees and people in Afghanistan. Thank you very much for being part of Sunday Nights.
Ahmed Shujar, our guest in this hour, speaking with Noel Debien.